Today we're going to talk about how we drift into fragility. My name is Matt Provost. I'm here from Wellington, New Zealand. I work at Weta Digital, which is Sir Peter Jackson's visual effects facility. Everybody else is busily putting the finishing touches on the second Hobbit movie right now, but I managed to escape. And so going back, I'll start with a story. In March this year, we're really busy doing the final rendering on Iron Man 3. So everything was in lockdown and we were just going flat out trying to get the movie done. When one of our core file systems called Vol Weta, which is just sort of an accumulation of scripts and utilities and all kinds of things from over the years, it started to come under load and slow down all these little utilities that were running. So we had a quick meeting and decided to put an NFS cache in front of it, which is something that we do on dozens and dozens of different file systems as they come under load. So that was deemed to be quite a safe thing to do. So we made the change. We pointed one chassis of servers at it, ran it for a few hours. That went fine. Put two racks of servers with that configuration, ran them overnight. Everybody was happy in the morning. So we cut over the entire facility, and within 2 hours, all rendering had ceased, and we were dead in the water. So this talk is about how safe changes, or what we perceive to be safe changes, can lead to outages, essentially how complex systems can fail. And it's based on a couple of books that I've been reading. One is Drift into Failure by Sidney Decker, which is all about complexity theory and draws on a lot of examples out of his sort of field of study, which is aircraft safety. So it's if you want to read about how planes crash or about how space shuttles crash, all that kind of stuff, it's a really good book. And the sort of central message of it, quoting him, is that the growth of complexity in society has got ahead of our understanding of how complex systems work and fail. Our technologies have gone ahead of our theories. The other book is Nassim Nicholas Taleb's Antifragile, which came out last year. Kind of a big one. This one's a lot more autobiographical and deals with a lot of his background, which is in kind of economics and finance. But I think both of these books have a lot to say about just complex systems in general, which is what system administrators manage. And again, to quote him, the central message is, it is far easier to figure out if something is fragile than to predict the occurrence of an event that may harm it. Fragility can be measured, risk is not measurable. And so going back to Decker's book, he identifies the original way that we sort of think about systems theory is going back to Newton and Descartes in the 17th century. So really our fundamental understanding of these things is about 300 years old. And this was during the scientific revolution. So anything that we tend to think of these days as sort of analytic or scientific or rational is really coming off the foundation that these two guys laid. And the reductionism part of it is that to understand a complex system, what you do is you break it up into components that you can understand. And if you break it up into components and you can't understand a component, you break that component up into smaller components that you can then understand. And you just keep doing this, of course, the computer science term is recursively, until you have a whole bunch of little components that you completely understand, and then you can piece back together into a complete understanding, front to back, top to bottom, of how the system works. And it was sort of that Newtonian ideal that of this physical universe where you can play things forward and backwards in time and understand everything. So this has led to something that in the 20th century we call the rational choice theory, which is that people make decisions by systematically and consciously weighing all possible outcomes along all relevant criteria. So if something happens, if there is some negative event, someone can be found negligent if they didn't avoid actions that could have been foreseen to have led to those negative effects. In other words, 20/20 hindsight. But this is also behind, particularly going back to sort of aircraft safety, the idea that in most cases crashes are blamed on pilot error, because if they had known all the information and made exactly the right choices, then maybe the maybe the crash wouldn't have happened. But of course it did. So what went wrong? Taleb calls the same thing the Soviet Harvard delusion, which he says the overestimation, particularly by educated people, of the reach of scientific knowledge. And of course, the idea that the Soviets could plan out how many tractors they were going to build for the next 5 years and get it right, or that Harvard economists could predict what the economy is going to look like 5 years from now and without missing huge crashes or booms, which of course they can't. And Taleb breaks systems down into three categories that he calls the central triad: fragile, robust, and anti-fragile, which is sort of a word that he coined, anti-fragile. So fragile systems don't like volatility. They like things to kind of stay the same, and they can cope with it. You can turn a fragile system into a robust system, which kind of doesn't care what happens to it. It doesn't really react very much. And in system administration, we do this by making things redundant. What he says is we should be doing is making systems anti-fragile, where they actually like deviation and volatility and react to that in a positive way and become stronger because of it. So in essence, the fragile wants tranquility, the anti-fragile grows from disorder, and the robust doesn't care too much. And one of the things this says to me as a system administrator is that sometimes this sort of a cult of uptime that we have really has to change. And if that all you're doing is building robust systems, you're not building things that can react in a positive way to having changes. And these are all three types of complex systems. So what is a complex system? A complex system is an open system. That means the boundaries are fuzzy. You can't tell where it starts and ends. In other words, this is anything connected to the internet. So you think you're responsible for your system, which is maybe an Apache server or something, but it's connected to the internet, which of course has all these routers and things in the way, and then the clients on the other side and the browsers that they're running and the operating systems that they're running, and of course they're interacting with your server. So where is really the edge of your system and the edge of your responsibility? It's fuzzy, right? A bug on somebody's laptop operating system can affect your server in a negative way, and you have to react to that. We experienced this recently, not knowing the boundaries of the systems. We set up a graphite server to do some internal metrics analysis. And some other department said, hey, I heard you had a graphite server. Can we put some stuff in there? We said, yeah, sure, why not? And then a few weeks later, we turned the server off to update the OS. And once again, render stopped for about 5 minutes because some team had been pushing metrics in there with no retry. So the call was just hanging, waiting for the server to come back up. And this kind of thing happens all the time, right? Like you make a dev system and the next thing you know, it's in production. And you never really had that conversation about like, are we going to take this dev system and put it in production? And it's because I don't have control over that, right? It's just a system on the network. People are using it in a way I hadn't anticipated. So what I thought was, again, a safe thing to do, because it's an open system, turned out to be an unsafe thing to do. Another part of complex systems is that they're affected by the thing that everybody knows is called the butterfly effect, which was named by Edward Lorenz, and which is defined as a sensitive dependence on initial conditions. So, of course, little changes as you set things up can have big effects later on. He was talking about it in distance terms. It can also be in time terms, as we'll see. And what this says is that complexity is a feature of the system, not of the individual components. So accidents and outages emerge from the relationships between the components, even when no component itself is broken. And I think we've all experienced this of, everything is working, but the system is down. So what's the problem? Complex systems also have state, which Dekker calls history or path dependence. And this is related to that butterfly effect, is that the sequence of events that led to the sort of current point in time has an effect on the system. In computer science, we call this state. And I think, you know, if we look at different computer systems, we can see the level of complexity between stateless and stateful systems. As we talk about, the classic example, of course, is UDP TCP. UDP is stateless. It's really simple. TCP has a lot of state in the protocol and is really complex. I mean, just look at the number of congestion avoidance algorithms that have been done over the years. You know, Reno, New Reno, Tahoe, Cubic. There's a whole bunch of them out there. And of course, as the system grows, you have to deal with all those interactions, right? So you're running a TCP server. Well, what if that client is running the Reno algorithm and your server is running Cubic? Now you have to deal with that. And what if a third client comes in, right? And I think, you know, if we look around at a lot of the big successful protocols, they're ones that try to avoid this complexity by remaining stateless. So we do a lot of NFS. NFS is stateless up until version 4, which nobody's really using. HTTP is stateless, right? So you can think of the complexity of that situation of, you know, it's the middle of the night, one of your Apache servers crashes, what do? You log in and you restart it, and everything picks up and goes on, compared to something like a MySQL server crashing in the middle of the night, which has so much state in it that can be quite a much more difficult job to get back up and running and to get all the clients sort of reconnected, and then they have to figure out where they were in their queries, and you know, it goes on from there. So HTTP is stateless, and that's been a big part of its success because it's simple. So trying to make systems reliable often makes them more complex. And redundancy doesn't provide protection against systemic threats, just against the stability of individual components. And in fact, this attempt to make things redundant can often make things worse. So when something does fail, in a sort of classic environment, the hunt begins for what Dekker calls the eureka part. So this is like, you know, the system's down, what broke, right? And you're going to start this hunt, and eventually you'll find, aha, it was this, and now we know what it was. And of course, in the modern world, systems are increasingly reliable across sort of all fields, not just computers. You know, planes are more reliable, cars are more reliable, everything's more reliable. So often the least reliable part of it is the human operator. So typically the answer when you start on this quest to find the eureka part, it's the person that hit enter. But this also means that root cause analysis in a complex system is of limited benefit because the exact circumstances that led to that failure are unlikely to happen again. So in many cases, unless it was kind of one of these things of like, I did this and that was bad, then it's like, well, don't do that again. But in many cases, the best thing that you can do to deal with a failure of a complex system is nothing. Because of that whole butterfly effect and state, lining up you know, the planets in exactly the same way to have that failure happen again is actually pretty unlikely. So going back to the story, what we found after hunting around for this eureka part was that there was one file, which was one of our core utility scripts, out of the 13 million files that we had cached that day. So pretty minuscule. But it had been compiled as 32-bit. And the cache that we put it behind, when you do a stat, it had assigned it a 64-bit inode. Actually, probably not a full 64-bit inode, but of course anything over 33 bits would break it. And the program was actually calling a stat on itself to find out if it had the correct file permissions. But the stat call doesn't care that you're just looking at file permissions. It also returns the inode, which then overflows and bails out. So that was failing. And the reason it was compiled as 32-bit, it was because there was a web page on our internal web servers that would sometimes call this utility that some department wrote many, many years ago. And for other interesting reasons, some of our internal web servers are still Debian Sarge from 2005. Because we're running a bunch of pages in a really old version of Perl Mason, which can't be upgraded without, you know, it's a whole story. And that's kind of what this is all about. But that was the eureka part, right, was this 64-bit inode. So Decker calls this the Newtonian ethic of failure, this hunt for sort of root causes and eureka parts. And the idea is that at the end of it, you're going to come up with one true story. And there's just going to be this one thing, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then it failed. And you write that up as a postmortem. So now that we have a little bit of background into how to approach these systems, we'll just have a quick look at some public postmortems. And the thing I'm looking for here is not to actually analyze the failure itself, but the language that gets used. So this was an Amazon AWS failure, or EBS failure, where they essentially had, you know, a whole page of stuff, but they sum it up in one line. The root cause of the problem, blah, blah, blah. This is the eureka part. And interesting, this is from 2012. An earlier one in 2011, somebody was reading the same books. So in this case, they identified that there are probably several root causes. There isn't one true story. The other interesting part is that they're saying that it gives us many opportunities to protect it against reoccurring, which is kind of true. But like we said before, I mean, first of all, the chances that the exact same sequence of events would happen again is pretty unlikely. And even if it were, if you have five things that you could potentially fix, if you fixed any one of them, then that exact sequence of events wouldn't have happened and you wouldn't have had the outage. It was the combination of all of those things. But all of those things were necessary for it to happen. And the way we get into these situations, Decker calls decrementalism, which is really the drift that he's talking about in the title of his book. And of course, you have a running system. Why mess with it? Because there's pressure from uncertainty and competition for resource. You know, the business is requiring you to make changes. So people make small steps or changes to the complex system. And of course, everyone at the time agrees that these are all safe. We're not talking about risk for risk's sake. But in complex systems, doing the same thing twice doesn't lead to the same results. So past success cannot be a guarantee of future safety. Which, again, going back to the whole sort of butterfly effect kind of thing, but you'll see this a lot. Again, let's have a look at some sort of prominent postmortems that have come out. And I'll just be clear, I'm not kind of pointing the finger at these companies. It's really great that they put this data out there for everybody to read and learn from, as opposed to places that just sort of cover it up. But you'll often see this, once you understand the language, right at the beginning of a postmortem, right? Some language like this, like, well, we thought we were doing it was safe because we've done it before. But of course, the system that you did it before isn't the same system, you know, from one day to the next that you're doing it on now. So why would you think that because you did it once before safely that that same thing would apply? But that's just human nature. Cloudflare had a similar thing. We do this all the time, but then we did it once, and boom. Another GitHub one. We put in redundant systems. We built it so it would work. Obviously, it didn't, or they wouldn't have been writing this. And that really kind of gets back to this rational choice theory about people making good decisions based on only information. But it does seem there's instinct to sort of justify yourself, right? And you say, I did what I thought was safe. Well, obviously, right? We're all professionals. Nobody's going to say, well, I knew it was pretty risky, you know. I kind of thought it would blow up, and I did it anyway, and it turned out it did. But you see this language over and over, right? People sort of establishing the fact that, like, from my point of view, this was a safe thing to do. And the truth is that there kind of is no safe thing to do, I guess. If there was, our jobs would be pretty easy. So once you have a failure, you know, how do you respond? Oh, here's another one, sorry. Another Amazon one. Taleb calls the response often iatrogenics, which is Greek. It means an illness caused by medical examination or treatment. So this is when you go to the doctor and you come out sicker than when you went in, which is unfortunately often what happens in our field of work as well. You can talk about the Hippocratic Oath. I think everybody knows the famous line from the Hippocratic Oath, which actually doesn't appear in it, but first do no harm. Right, and that should be the sort of guiding principle. Is don't make things worse. He also calls this tendency naive interventionism. And he says that nature loves small errors, but humans don't. So we try to make systems, you know, more redundant or more robust, but what we're actually doing is making them fragile by trying to protect them. And to go back to the story. So what ended up happening? You know, we made the change, we tested it on 32 servers, it was fine. We tested it overnight on 2 racks of servers. We got through everything. How did we miss it? Well, we missed it because we set up our renders to retry a certain number of times before they give up and fail. And this is due to the fact that you know, sometimes they can end up on a bad node that has like a hung NFS mount or something, so it'll retry somewhere else. Sometimes they'll just run out of memory competing with other processes, and they might have better luck trying on a node that has more free memory, something like that. So this was a system that we set up to protect ourselves and to get through renders. But what, of course, was happening was that we had 2 racks out of, I don't know, maybe 40. With this one new setting, it would run on there, fail, try again. Chances are it would land on a rack that didn't have that setting applied and go through. So this was a system that we set up to sort of protect ourselves, but in the end, it contributed to the full, you know, the full site outage. And there are always a ton of stories out there about these sort of unintended side effects. A big one that's sort of going around the internet now is buffer bloat, you know, where network devices are being overly paranoid about dropping packets. So they put in big RAM buffers to buffer a whole bunch of packets. But what it's doing is basically killing network throughput on the internet, because every little, your cable modem has a big buffer, and your laptop has a buffer, and the router has a buffer, you know, and everybody's buffering stuff up. But everyone, you know, the manufacturers are doing this out of an attempt to sort of be protective and say, I'm not going to drop a packet if I can't. But there's these unintended side effects. In fact, for throughput, you'd be better off just dropping the packets and letting sort of TCP do what it does. So redundant systems can help us hide failures. There's a great thing that came off this British show, Yes, Prime Minister, called the Politician Syllogism. And I think for sysadmins, this sort of reaction to an outage is a pretty common one. Right, this is often a conversation that happens after an outage, especially when, you know, confronted with a bunch of choices, right? Like back to that Amazon thing, there's a whole bunch of ways we could fix this. What are we gonna do? I don't know, here's something, let's just do it. Just so we can look like we're doing something. And the best weapon against this, according to Taleb, is so he says, procrastination is our natural defense. It lets things be anti-fragile. Because we hate things with volatility, and we hate these little outages, and especially, I think the human instinct is we're particularly bad at filtering short-term information. So something just went down and caused us a bunch of pain, and we want to fix it. That's our first instinct. But this is a natural filter. If you wait a week and then have another sort of sit down and think, well, you had 5 options of different ways you could fix it. You could either sit down and do all 5, or you could wait a week and you could say, well, let's just, you know, the one that in the back of your brain you think is the highest probability of actually fixing it without causing other side effects will sort of bubble to the top. You know, you have a whole list of other things to do with your day, so you're not going to do all five anymore. The pain of that event has passed, and you'll do one. You'll pick one, and this is a way of helping your brain do that. So what Decker talks about too is moving away from this sort of physics-based approach to things, the Newtonian sort of ideal of being able to track everything, and moving towards a more biological approach. And that's really where a lot of this sort of 20th century complexity theory has come out of, is biology, which has really been the sort of last bastion in the fight. You know, like I said before, you know, when you think of the scientific revolution and analytics and the word science itself, it's all sort of based in physics and this Newtonian ideal that we can sort of predict everything. And for a while, everybody thought that's how it was going to work, right? We can predict the orbits of planets. We'll actually be able to sort of model chemistry in a physics-based sense and the interaction of atoms and everything. But biology has really resisted this. Biological systems are incredibly complex. And you can't break them down into equations, or at least nobody's been able to just yet. So if we look to biology, we'll get some ideas about how to respond to these. There's a great word, bricolage. It comes from Francois Jacob, who is a French biologist, when he was talking about biological systems and their search for options. Taleb defines it as trial and error close to tweaking, trying to make do with what you've got by recycling pieces that would otherwise be discarded, which to me sounds like a lot of what we do as system administrators, is you sort of have this stuff, put it all together, try it in different combinations, see what works. This is how biological systems work. Of course, the word for that is evolution. Herbert Spencer, not Darwin, coined the term survival of the fittest. The sort of counterpoint to that isn't always talked about is death of the unfit. And this is something that I think you know, we need to focus on. As systems evolve, right, even in biological terms, there aren't any dinosaurs around anymore. We have to get rid of old systems. And this is, I think, one of the key weapons in the sort of fight against complexity. So there are so many examples of this. We have one where, you know, years and years ago we needed a graphing system, so we installed MRTG, like everybody did, which was great. And then we needed some other feature, so Cricut got installed, if anybody remembers that. And then we ended up with Cacti, which is good for a while, and now we're using Graphite. But of course, up until a few months ago, when I finally killed the cron job that had been running every minute for 10 years, we had all four of these systems running concurrently. Because somebody would, you know, you'd have your MRTG running and then it didn't do something, so you'd install Cricut and you do that, but you would never move all the graphs over, or somebody liked some feature of the old system. You know, we're still struggling to, you know, have Cacti and Graphite coexist because some people are really, you know, familiar with the Cacti interface and don't want to move. And so, of course, the systems get more and more complex as there are more and more of them. And just as an industry, we're in this sort of crossroads as well. You know, I can think of two big examples of this at the moment. One of them is SSDs and hard drives, you know, which are two different technologies for doing the same thing. You can end up with them in the same server, and now you have to deal with, you know, two completely different performance characteristics and two completely different failure modes, right? And like, SSDs don't fail in the same way that hard drives do, and all our experience about dealing with hard drive failures doesn't necessarily apply. So you can have a data center or a server with both of these technologies, and now it's two things that you have to deal with. The other one are virtual machines, or the cloud, I guess, and physical servers, right? Where, you know, you have a data center, it's got a bunch of physical servers you decide to virtualize, but you probably don't virtualize everything. So you have now this virtual stack, and you have to know how to deal with, you know, VMware and vCenter and ESX and all these new technologies, but you're also still dealing with ILO and RAID batteries and hard disk replacements and all the horrible things that physical servers have. Where if you just cut over and had, and you know, 100% environment one way or the other, you know, especially heading towards, you know, if you move towards the cloud, and you can actually shut down your data center, then there's just one data center to worry about. But most people sort of keep their data center and Amazon's data center, and now you have two UPSs to worry about and two generators to worry about and all that kind of thing. I mean, you're paying somebody else to worry about it. But as an industry, we go through these transitions, and there's this sort of middle phase where you have a sort of foot in both sides, and the complexity of the system increases. You know, it's also kind of a time-based thing. So looking back, you know, at this whole 64-bit issue, the RFC for NFS version 3 came out in 1995, so 18 years ago. It's old enough to vote. And it specified that inodes are 64-bit. So why would any sort of modern Linux throw an error on that? Well, because nobody really implemented it. And, you know, the other thing is we you know, those old Debian Sarge machines, well, the hardware was getting old, so we virtualized them. So now they're immortal, right? Now there's no motivation to upgrade them because the hardware is never going to fail. Eventually, we have to get rid of them. I couldn't do a talk about Decker's book without having some planes. We'll just do this quickly, but if anybody can see kind of a pattern to the pictures I'm going to show, go ahead and yell it out. It may or may not be obvious. Close. So these planes were all from a time after World War II where they were just figuring out jets, and they had planes that had jets and propellers. You don't see planes like this anymore. They finally figured jets out. And you know, there's still some planes with propellers for certain reasons, and most planes have jet engines. But for a time period, they had both. And it was, you know, you can imagine the sort of complexity of the system and the compromises you have to make. Like the jet engines would either have to run on avgas, or the propeller engines would have to run on jet fuel. You have to have two completely different sets of mechanics. But, you know, to me, this is a data center with physical servers and virtual machines. And eventually we're going to move past it, and you'll just have like a, you know, nice new Boeing 787, and it's going to be much easier to maintain. So how do we build, you know, anti-fragile systems? Well, the idea behind an anti-fragile system is that shocks to it, or deviation or volatility, brings more benefit or less harm kind of as the intensity increases. And I think everybody's probably heard about clever guys like Netflix. They read these same books. Adrian probably put me onto these books, actually. You know, they have their chaos monkey that goes around their virtual machines and just turns things off at random. But then their system is anti-fragile, right? It knows how to deal with that. And so it recovers from it really quickly. You know, that's the idea behind it, is that volatility in the system actually makes it much stronger than it would have been initially. And we've been trying to do some stuff like this, but of course we're not Netflix and we don't have that kind of resource, and a lot of people don't. But we came up with some really simple things. I came up with one called Cron Monkey, which is just the really simple version of Chaos Monkey. And we did this for some dev servers. We had some old hardware lying around, and some of the developers found out about it and said, hey, can I have those servers to run a test cluster or something? And I said, yeah, but as a condition of you having this old hardware, I'm going to put a cron job on it that reboots it every night at midnight. You know, when you're not here, whatever, and you just make sure you're, you know, you've set up your init scripts so it all comes up properly. But what that means is I'm going to know within 24 hours when that dev server slips into production. Because as soon as it's in production, that midnight, it's going to reboot, something's going to break, I'm going to hear about it, and I can react to it within sort of 24 hours of that code release going out, as opposed to it drifting into production and us finding out about it 6 months later. I mean, this would have been a great fix for that problem with the graphite server if I wanted to have a 5-minute gap in my graphs every night at midnight. So there are obviously you know, trade-offs, but this is something, you know, on a sort of small scale. You're introducing volatility into the system. Another example I have is like many people, you know, we're running big NFS. We have snapshots turned on a lot of our file systems. We're also backing things up to disk and then to tape for sort of longer term. But of course, the risk with backup systems is that they sort of fade away and you don't test them often enough, right? And what we're doing is we're trying to protect ourselves. So we put in these snapshots where people can just get their data back really quickly. But we're hiding all that volatility of people just deleting files and getting them back. We're hiding that from ourselves. So eventually what happens is somebody deletes something and the snapshots don't have it or whatever, and then they come to you and they say, hey, can you get it out of your backup system? And you say, well, maybe, let me see. And then you discover that your backup system hasn't been working for a month or something like that. Whereas if you sort of embrace that volatility and said, well, we're not going to do snapshots, just every time you delete a file, you have to come to me and I'll restore it for you, then your backup system's going to be really reliable, right? You're going to know within a few days if you're not backing up properly because you're exercising it all the time. But we try to hide that sort of volatility from ourselves. Another one, a case of suppressed volatility that we have is with, we have a small Cassandra cluster. It was always, it was designed with like striped RAID because Cassandra handles mirroring the data to multiple servers. So, you don't need all this, but it was a real pain for the sysadmin team. Every time a hard drive went, the server would die or sort of partially die. That was always, of course, the worst case or partial failures. And you'd have to take it out of the node, take it out of the Cassandra cluster and put a new hard drive in and rebuild it. So eventually the guys got sick of doing that and they rebuilt all the Cassandra nodes as RAID 5. So now we're running Cassandra on top of RAID, which is kind of a completely silly thing to do because it's already doing that for you. But we've hidden that volatility from ourselves. The problem is we've only accounted for one kind of failure. So, one of the problems people have with Cassandra clusters, I hear, is that you run them kind of too close to the edge. You're right up against the limits of performance, and then when something goes wrong, you can't recover from it because you don't have enough sort of CPU or disk or whatever to recover. So we protected against disk failures, but what if there was a CPU failure on one of the nodes? Now it's going to fail, and we may find out that the rest of the cluster doesn't have enough compute power to keep up with the workload that's been running on it. So we've actually made the system more fragile in the long-term sense by trying to cover up for this one failure mode. And one of the ways you can work around these kind of things is by having a lot of diversity. I'll show you guys this. So this is the sort of classic single-person diversity trick, rubber duck debugging. But you want to get a lot of opinions into how you build these things. You want to make small changes and have a lot of eyes on it. And if there's only you making a change, this is a classic programmer trick. You put a rubber duck on your desk and you explain the problem to it. And usually by explaining it out loud, you'll figure it out. So it's sort of a quick way of tricking yourself into it. The other thing that we like to use are some of the sort of agile methodologies. We find Kanban works really well for sort of systems teams, where instead of having people disappear for long periods of time to go work on a project, on a daily basis, you say, here's what I'm going to do today. And that gives a lot of room for a diversity of opinion where somebody can say, hey, did you think about doing it this way? Or, oh, did you know there's an update for that? Or, hey, wait a second, don't do that. You want to get a lot of eyes on these problems. And the other thing we've done is change around the sort of traditional, I've been on a lot of systems teams, and the sort of traditional weekly meeting is often pretty retrospective, right? You get everybody together and everybody says, here's what I did last week. And sort of rattles off their accomplishments. But that doesn't really help because it's already done and in production and rolled out. So what we've done is turned our weekly meeting into a purely proactive one. You don't talk about what you did last week, you talk about what you're going to do this week. And that gives everybody else in the room that opportunity to bring ideas to the table and try to help make these systems less fragile. Another good way of introducing a little bit of volatility into the system is by going away. We all know there are some systems out there that just can't run without sort of constant tweaking, and that sort of creates this idea that you just can't leave it alone. So everybody in the audience that has a terminal window open is part of the problem. Try going somewhere without a cell phone for a couple weeks and see how your systems do. That's a really good way of testing if there's a single point of human failure in your systems. The other trick that Taleb talks about are heuristics, which he calls little rules of thumb that make things simple to implement. The main advantage of them, and he says you can't forget this, is that the user knows they're not perfect. So they are just rules of thumb. You say in most cases this is going to be true, right? The sort of classic one is that JWZ one about, you know, you have a problem, you think I'll use a regex, now you have two problems, right? So it's like just a funny little thing, but you know, in the back of your mind, anytime you go to use a regex, you say, am I doing a JWZ? No, I actually need it this time. Like this is, you know, or you say, yeah, actually that's probably too complex of a solution for this problem. In the common case, it's often a way of getting yourself into trouble. So it's not a universal rule, but it's just a quick way of having these. I kind of put together a list of some things that I thought there's positive and negative heuristics. These are negative heuristics, sort of things not to do that are always warning signs for me when I see them coming up, or you sort of think, I have a problem, I know, I'll use a host file. That's a recipe for making a fragile system that's going to break you later on. I had root log in there as opposed to sudo. Cargo cult reboots, I call those are the ones where it's just like, we reboot that server every Thursday. Why? Well, because we think it makes it better if it just has a, you know, a rest every once in a while. So the way we need to think about these complex systems and the way risk interacts with them is by going up and out. That's the message of this, is instead of this Newtonian down and in, where we break it into components, you start breaking it into bigger and bigger pieces as you go up, and you try to find the causes sort of further and further away. So going back to that story, I mean, who was at fault, or what was the root cause of, you know, of that sort of 64-bit outage? Well, you know, the sysadmins pulled the trigger, right? We put the cache in place. We did that. It broke. Well, yeah, true. But it was because of all these circumstances. You know, nobody else running the system noticed that we had those two racks of systems that were failing all night because things were ultimately going through because we tried to predict it. You know, there is a way to compile 32-bit programs that they can understand 64-bit inodes. It's a compiler flag, but the team that compiled that tool didn't do it because they didn't know about it or because it didn't bother them at the time. The department that had written that website that was calling this tool years ago, they had actually stopped using that website years ago and had never told anybody. So we actually could have updated to 64-bit because nobody was actually using that code anymore. So in some sense, it was some guy in some department that whipped up a quick web page. Was the outage his fault, you know, 5-7 years later? Well, you know, it's not really about finding fault. It's about getting away from this idea that, you know, that there's one true story. There are many true stories. And by going up and out, you start looking at the problem in sort of bigger and bigger ways. Was it Linux's fault? Like, why was Linux failing 18 years, you know, after the NFS RFC was written? It's still failing to handle these inodes properly. Or was it just a fundamental Unix problem? Why does the stack call return the inode when all you're interested in are the file permissions? Maybe that was a bad design. And so again, it's not about necessarily finding like a root cause that you can fix. The fix was easy, but it's about understanding the whole scope of the problem and coming up with all of these different true stories that help us manage complex systems. Thanks.
I'd just like to point out that in your example of not doing the snapshots, which will force you to exercise your backup, actually the more likely outcome is no one will ever delete anything.
That's already a problem, yeah.
So there was a lot of useful little bits and pieces in there, and one that reminded us, the GTAPE backup team in Google have a rule that if any group that backs stuff up but don't do a test restore once a month, they just delete the backups.
That's a good rule.
Which is a really interesting one. And you have to prove that you've tested the backups. Also, have you seen Kripa, I can't remember how to pronounce her second name. She was a Google project manager who runs something called Dirt, but she did an interview with ACM describing how disaster recovery testing works. And it's,
okay, now.
It brings this to kind of 11, where you get an organization, get a few thousand people together and say, okay, let's test everything that could possibly break.
Right.
But yeah, definitely check that out.
Yeah, yeah. That actually sounds a little bit Newtonian, is we're going to understand this entire system and how it's going to break ahead of time. Where this is saying you can't ever know, you just have to make systems that can cope with whatever, which is a different goal. But I think there's room for both.
I wonder if you've updated your test procedures to detect when the renders are actually not running successfully on your test rack.
Yeah, there's actually, I would love to, is the short answer. It's in progress. There are sort of periodic sweeps of failures for all kinds of different reasons, so this was just one of them, but. No, that's exactly what we want to start doing. I gave another talk yesterday about how we monitor things, and you can take the same approach with monitoring, right? It's like you can monitor each and every like little component of every server and alert when anything fails, or you can go up and out and say, tell me when the system isn't behaving. Tell me when the error rate is higher than it should be. You know, tell me when this service isn't working, even though it's got a whole bunch of redundant parts. And so that's how we're trying to move all of our monitoring, is kind of along these lines to sort of bigger and bigger instead of, you know, sort of micromanaging.
Two things. First, given my love of dinosaurs, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that birds were dinosaurs. and also, I had considered the fact that we constantly deal with kind of system archaeology when we're going through old services, you know, like you said, you know, you've got this service, then you install that service, and pretty soon you've got this giant, you know, Chechen pyramid of you know, like Chichen Itza, which is just built on top of each other again and again. I was wondering if you had considered, because I hadn't until you said that, maybe like an undeployment plan as part of the initial deployment plan. Like, this is what this is, and here's how we tear this building down when we're done with it, like as part of that.
Yeah, I've been trying to do a one-in, one-out kind of philosophy for systems. Like, oh, you're going to bring this in to replace that? Then it has to replace it. Like, you have a month where they can both coexist, and then we're going to turn the other one off. You know, the problem out in the real world is that no two systems ever completely overlap. So there's always people around that are like, but I like the way the old system does, you know, X. And you really have to be a pretty good salesman and convince them that the new system does things better in order to sort of get permission to turn the old one off, which is always the hard one. And as I schedule the team, I try to also keep kind of as many people building new stuff as tearing down old stuff. Or, you know, replacing old equipment or whatever. You know, that's always sort of part of it, but you can defer it longer and longer and longer, and then you end up with that server sort of humming away in the corner for 10 years that everybody's forgotten about. So it's good to kind of have a hit list of, you know, what you want to kill as well. And you kind of work on that as a project priority, as well as like, here's all the new cool stuff we're going to do. And sometimes you sort of have to have that carrot and say, like, I'll let you install this cool thing if you go turn off that 10-year-old server, even if they're kind of unrelated systems, but that can kind of motivate people to do it. But it's tough. I mean, you know, VMs are making it so much worse. We're sort of approaching this like 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 kind of, you know, staff to VM ratio of, you know, people just create VMs and they're free, right? And they're going to sit there forever, and you can upgrade the hardware underneath them, and they'll keep going. And I don't know what it's going to look like in 5 years. I mean, we're going to have 5 VMs for every staff person, and nobody's going to know what any of them do. Where at least with physical servers, you could kind of do a walk around the data center and it's like, what is that? And pull the power cord out and see who yells. That's something we do from time to time. If we don't know who's responsible for it, just pull the power and see who emails.
The problem is VMs don't gather dust.
Right.
Sometimes that doesn't work before we close, though.
Yeah.
Just a little anecdote. I was over in France a few years ago, and if you drive around, you see these little stores out there called Monsieur Bricolage. And basically, they're sort of the derogatory term for like a little home improvement store where you like go and you buy your paint and you kind of slap it around. So that sort of fit in here.
Yeah, there's definitely the two sides to system administration, right? It's like building the huge racks full of like perfectly set up servers. And then there's the stuff we do day to day, which is some department needs something now. And okay, where can I find room for that? Where, you know, what open source project can I download to get that done? That's a big part of what we do, yeah. Cool, okay, well, thanks for your time.